Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, a show where we try to get information on topical areas of electronic discovery from national experts accessible to anyone for free online. I'm thrilled we have a wonderful show today, Electronic Discovery in Law School Curriculums. Our panelists include Judge Shinlin, who at the first National eDiscovery Conference I attended in New York City in late 2004 or early 2005, she was introduced to the audience as a rock star in the world of electronic discovery. She's a United States District Court judge for the Southern District of New York since September of 1994, and during her tenure, she has presided over a number of high-profile cases, many of which have advanced important new positions in the interpretation of the Constitution or federal law. In the world of electronic discovery, she's known for a number of prominent decisions, most famously in April 2004, the case Sugalake v. UBS Warburg, where Judge Shinlin sanctioned UBS for not being able to complete their e-discovery of potentially informative documents and not complying with their litigation hold on the destruction of documents. This case has been seen as revolutionary in the legal realms of human resources and computer forensics, as the burden of proof was effectively shifted to the defendant for their inability to produce documents in a timely manner and the presentation to the jury of an adverse inference. She's a prolific author and speaker and recently published a book for law students called Electronic Discovery and Digital Evidence, along with Professor Dan Capra from Fordham Law School and the Sedona Conference. I'm just thrilled to be doing this podcast with you, Judge Shinlin. We also have Ralph Losey, who's AKA the opening act on this podcast, but I promise we'll have a headlining event soon with Ralph, probably in May, on e-discovery ethics. Ralph's an attorney, author, nationally recognized expert in e-discovery, a shareholder at Ackerman Centerfit, which is an Am Law 100 law firm, and he's the chair of their e-discovery practice group. He's the author of the American Bar Association's two best-selling books on electronic discovery, and he's recently published a new book, Introduction to e-Discovery, New Cases, Ideas, and Techniques. Ralph's also an active blogger on e-Discovery, involved with the Sedona Conference, a frequent speaker. And Ralph, I appreciate having you on the show as well. So let's jump right in here. First of all, Judge Shinlin, why did you become interested in electronic discovery?
Well, it started out with my tenure as a member of the Advisory Committee on Civil Rules. At that time, we were taking up some rule changes that had nothing to do with e-discovery, and I remember receiving a comment from a lawyer that said, it's nice that you're doing what you're doing, but the real issue that the Rules Committee had better turn to soon is electronic discovery, and it was like a heads up. Nobody had ever heard about this. It was quite a while back, I would say 1999, a number of years back, 10 years now, a decade, and this lawyer was prescient. And I said, well, I'm going to jump on his suggestion. I'm going to just throw myself into it. So I wrote an article way back then, probably 2000, about whether Rule 34, as it was then written, was sufficient. And I found that it wasn't. And one thing then led to another. And the Rules Committee, as you know, then spent 6 years debating and drafting and eventually adopting a new set of rules. So that's the history for me.
Oh, Ralph, same question.
Well, I started back with computers going back to law school days in the late 70s, but insofar as a separate discipline, it wasn't until Judge Shinlin wrote Sugalake that I realized this it needed to now be a specialty. So I have a debt to you, Judge.
Thank you.
And I do, too. I came up with that bottle of wine 4C based on the Sugalake opinion, which I have sitting on my desk behind me. Thank you for autographing it, Judge Shinlin.
Right.
Okay. Well, now it's been 2 years since the federal rules were adopted, 4 years since your landmark decision in Sugalake. For both of you, do you think we're making progress in electronic discovery?
Well, I do. First of all, it has been 2 years since the new federal rules regarding e-discovery went into effect, but they've been in the public eye for more than 2 years because they were in draft and there was public comment and everybody knew they were coming. So in a way, they've been out there 4 years. And then the earliest Sugalake decision was 2003. So that's been 6 years. So I would say, you know, we are in that range of 4 to 6 years. And now everybody knows about e-discovery. There's nowhere in the country that you can go where attorneys and judges aren't aware, at least of the problem and of methods for addressing the problem. So it's in everybody's consciousness, and to that extent, we are making discovery. Lawyers do routinely discuss this now in their meet and confers. They do try to work out solutions. The court doesn't always see the problems because I think counsel are handling it, but it is a new world. Most records are created electronically, not on paper, and everybody's dealing with it. Whether everybody's up to speed enough is a different issue, particularly with respect to effective search techniques and cost issues. Maybe not everybody's up to the same level of speed, but everybody's aware of the problem. That's a good thing. I might even add that our government is aware of it. And you hear more and more now about the new administration having questions about electronic records in the medical field and other fields. So I would say we've made tremendous progress in the e-discovery area.
That's great. Well, jumping into
Did Ralph want to answer that?
Ralph, do you have anything to add to that? Or?
Well, I agree totally with Judge Shanlon on that. Consciousness-raising-wise, we've done it, I think. Actual skill teaching, I think we still have a long way to go. I agree with her on that. And I think that's one reason that the judge and I are both spent so much time writing to try and allow some more in-depth study.
Yeah, I know you have a new blog out constantly on this, so I know it's something you have a deep passion for. Now, Judge Shinlin, let's talk a little bit about your book you've recently written, the curriculum for law students called Electronic Discovery and Digital Evidence, which you wrote with Professor Dan Capra from Fordham Law School, and I with some help from the Sedona Conference. There's a real creative blog post on the internet called Teach Your Children Well, A Case for Teaching E-Discovery in Law Schools, written by Shannon Capone Kirk and Kristen Alley. Why do you see the need, Judge Shinlin, for law students to learn about electronic discovery?
Well, you know, there's an old phrase, softball up the middle. That question was really a softball up the middle. We've just said that the practice of law today involves nothing but electronic records. We used to say, you know, there's e-discovery as if it was a subset of all discovery, but now there's no other discovery. As the world shifts to electronic records, there are no paper records, and by the time today's graduates become lawyers, they will see hard copy as a thing of the past, boxes, warehouses, sorting through paper. I really don't think that's going to be the way they're going to practice. It's all electronic. So if they don't learn the techniques for working with electronic records efficiently, for thinking in advance about such things as form of production, search terms, search techniques, if they're not up to speed, they're going to just fall out. I mean, they're not going to cut it in the new world. Those of us who are a little older, shall I say modestly or immodestly, but it's too late for us. We can't really change completely. But for these young people coming out, the world will change with them. So it must be taught in law schools. I think it would almost be malpractice for a law school to graduate a young lawyer these days and not have exposed them to the very important and fascinating issues in e-discovery. Ralph, do you agree with that?
Totally. I mean, I'm going to be teaching law school again tomorrow at the University of Florida. I go up there once a week, and there's real enthusiasm there, the students. Not only that, they get it so much better than the CLEs that I do.
Right.
And plus, they have the time to really study it and get it. I mean, it takes just for one semester, and we do a two-credit course, which is typical in the other law schools that offer it. You're talking about 150 hours of dedicated study, including the 2 hours a week classroom and the 3 to 4 hours a week reading assignments and then preparing for the final exam. And this is what it takes. It is a complicated subject, and it's frankly embarrassing that there are so few law schools that are now teaching it. But I think that'll change soon, particularly with Judge Shinlin's excellent course book and the books I've written. There's now no excuse for law schools not to add it.
Well, thank you. That's one of the reasons I decided, along with Professor Capra, to undertake a casebook, because we felt that professors find it harder to teach a course when it's brand new and there's no casebook. Once you give them a casebook on a platter, it isn't that hard, and we thought this would add the possibility of a course in electronic discovery to more law schools. We did a survey before we wrote the book, and believe it or not, it is offered in, I think, more schools than you think. We found about 40 courses, all by adjuncts. But I think it's going to catch on, and I'm glad that Ralph agrees with that.
And, you know, I would say anecdotally there's a lot of interest in this area since we basically shut down the circuit for the show on the initial attempt at the podcast, and I sent this out to almost every law school in the country this morning. Mm. So, well, given the importance of this, do you think the course should be a core course in law school, just like torts, contracts, property, and other courses that we all have taken?
Well, no, actually, that I don't, because there'll be some areas of practice where a litigation skills course is not necessary. However, that said, if you'll forgive me again for just a small plug, just today, West has published a supplement that I've written along with Professor Capra called A Supplement to be Used in Civil Procedure Courses. What it is, it's kind of a reduced version of the casebook. And so in every civil procedure course, if the professor, usually a full-time professor, wants to add a segment about electronic discovery, maybe a 2 or 3 week segment, they could have the students purchase the supplement as opposed to the casebook, and at least they could make sure that everybody gets a small exposure to e-discovery in the first year. So that I would advocate. I would, you know, I'm sorry if these law schools are not on the phone, but maybe they can catch the podcast another time. But I think civil procedure professors really should consider at least a segment of their one-year course being devoted to this. As far as a standalone course in the core curriculum, I don't think that would be right, because the lawyers who are going into other fields, corporate law or, you know, secured transactions or whatever, it's not as important to focus on e-discovery as it is for litigators. So I look at it as a skills course, much like trial practice, appellate advocacy, that type of course.
And I'm sure my old friend Jim Michaelitz would say, why not a course on electronic records management while we're at it?
But right.
The next textbook. Ralph, you didn't have the benefit of the course materials from this book when you started teaching. How did you compile your course materials?
Well, actually, the person we're now teaching in third semester in a row, the prior adjunct started using my first book that came out last year. Students seem to like that. We welcome the addition of the more academically oriented one that Professor Capra and Judge Shinlin have created. But we also supplement it, as most of the adjuncts I've talked to that do it, by bringing in live practitioners. For instance, we had Jason Barron at the University of Florida a couple of weeks ago speaking about search and TREC, the research that's going on now about that, and I think that's also a good way to supplement it. But I'll tell you, there's now a big hunger of law students. Might be one reason we flooded the switchboards. When we put our course up, it was offered in this January for the semester. It sold out. We decided to cap it at 40 students. It was completely filled in a half hour of online registration. And the reason is the students get it, and they want and need the advantage to get a job and to get ahead in their law firms. And this is really, it's a shame that the law schools are not offering it. They're really disadvantaging their students by not having this opportunity to take advantage of what they know and really help out the profession at the same time.
Judge Shinlin, given that comment and understanding the book just recently came out, and law schools tend to go on a, you know, regimented, you know, it's time to do our course a year beforehand, getting it slotted. But are you getting any feedback on how your book's being received from law schools?
You mean now the casebook, not
the casebook,
not
yep.
The new supplement, which is just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the casebook wasn't published till December, so we just got it out. Barely a few weeks before the spring semester. So we didn't have too much hope that it would be picked up for courses in the spring semester. But I am hoping, as people hear about the existence of the casebook, and that's really not for me to publicize, but if West Publishing is talking, I guess it's called Thomson Reuters now, but that's our publisher, if they're meeting with law schools, their representatives are meeting with law schools, word of mouth is good. But hopefully as the schools become aware of it, it will be used. I can't say that. I mean, I hope it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just did a podcast about a week and a half ago with Judge Facciola, and he's deeply concerned that lawyers need to learn something about electronic discovery if they're litigators or they miss malpractice, or they're really risking malpractice. In fact, he gave a couple of examples of what he thought were pretty darn close to malpractice committed in his courtroom. Do you see that same type of need from your perspective on the bench?
Well, yes. I mean, that's why CLEs have been so popular in the electronic discovery area. And I will say there are many publications. Obviously, Ralph Losey is a real leader in this field, having published and published. But there are plenty of books out there. Just, of course, to add to the library shelf, I am coming out with a third book with Professor Capra, and that will be a nutshell. I don't know if you've seen the West nutshell over the year, but it's a narrative. It's not like a case book. It doesn't have the case in it. It's a narrative. Again, it's based on the case book, so it's a third publication. We have the case book, the supplement for civil procedure, and the nutshell should be out in about 2 months. And I'm hoping the nutshell would be attractive not only to law schools but to members of the bar, because it's easy reading. I mean, you can just read through any nutshell in any area. It's not very hard. But I'm not saying that's something new. There are many good books out there that lawyers can and should be buying. So I agree with Judge Facciola completely. Lawyers have to be up to speed, and I think they're trying. I do think they're trying. That's why, as I said, CLEs have been popular.
Ralph, you can take a shot at this first. I'd like to get both your opinions. I mentioned the blog post earlier that I found interesting that mentioned the book, and there's a quote in there that I changed a little bit, but it said, "The legal practice lawyers endure now is a dizzying hell as lawyers navigate the uncharted seas of e-discovery, the sanctions, the technology, the new technology, the newer technology, the vendors, the review platforms, the advanced review platforms, review platforms 2.0, 3.0, 4.0, 5.0, etc. The hold orders, the 30B6 depositions, the conflicting law, metadata, EGADs, metadata's ugly stepsister, embedded data, and then local rules, and the sanctions again. OR hell did slowly go by, but it doesn't have to be that way." Do you have a reaction to that, and how can law school courses help to solve this?
Well, I agree with what Judge Shindlin said earlier, and that is, we're kind of hopelessly, as Ken Withers likes to say, proto-digital, Judge Shindlin and I, in that we grew up with paper. But now those days are over. It's now digital. So it's a little difficult for us senior litigators, anybody, as I think it was Jason Barron likes to say, that's actually seen the Apollo moon landing is probably too old to get it. So that's why a lot of us put our hope in the law schools. But we can't really wait that long, and CLEs are important. And I really think the answer to this, and Shannon Kirk, who wrote that guest blog about Teach Your Children Well, as she's involved in that, as am I at Ackerman, and that is setting up specialty areas within law firms where there's attorneys that do e-discovery and only do e-discovery, such as myself. That's all I do. And it is a complicated field. Zuba Lake is the beginning of a long journey of study and understanding. And just like we have antitrust specialists, we're going to have e-discovery specialists. And that's just the way that it's going to be, I think, going forward in order to deal with the just incredible complexities of the IT systems as the architecture of all of this, as Judge Shindlin mentions in Zuba Lake, is constantly evolving, and it becomes really a full-time job to keep up with this.
Well, I'll just throw in a couple words here. I'm a little bit concerned about the risk of conflating a law education, a legal education, with a technical education. I don't think that we can turn all lawyers into computer specialists. And there are some lawyers who have a love of computers, and they really do both fields. And probably Ralph Losey is one of them, and there are a couple others who come to mind. But many lawyers are really lay people. They don't have an engineering background, a science background, a math background. And they're never going to implement technology. But what I think is important is that they at least identify when they need help, the questions they should ask, the places they should go. We just want them to be educated and conversant with the field, even though we may not expect all lawyers to become technical specialists.
Those are good points. Now in the world of a young lawyer, a law student breaking in, You know, is this something that we're going to have to wait to germinate? Because I remember being a first-year associate, and it was hard to set strategy when you were just trying to find a work assignment in a firm.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that question.
Well, do you expect it to take a while for the law students to actually be able to make contributions within law firms?
Well, I don't expect a law student. You mean a young lawyer?
A young lawyer who's gone through these courses.
Well, that's interesting. The young lawyers, as Ralph said earlier in this podcast, are going to be ahead of the more senior partners because they're just going to be more conversant with computers and computer technology. So I think we've seen already in law firms that the more senior people turn to the more junior people for their sort of youthful knowledge and energy to take a leadership role in e-discovery projects. I think a young lawyer has a lot to contribute when usually he or she would not.
Yeah, that's a good point. Anytime you have a differentiating skill in a firm, it's not a bad thing too. Well, 40 schools, I guess, was the number that was thrown out. I haven't shepherdized or checked that, are offering electronic discovery. And I know that there's about, I think, 180 or 190 accredited law schools that are out there. Do you think the law schools have moved quickly enough into this area to add courses on electronic discovery? Ralph, we'll start with you, but I'd like both your opinions.
In the past, no. But I think that's rapidly changing, and I think that may be a positive benefit of the economic crisis, if you can try and find one, is that they're starting to be more practical. Many schools, and I'm talking the top-tier schools, have had an attitude of, discovery is beneath us. It's not the kind of thing professors write about. There are not that many circuit appeal decisions on it. But I think the academic community needs to get real and face the fact that this is a serious problem that the bar is facing, and we need the help of the academic community, and we need to have professors start teaching this, not just adjuncts. And I'm hopeful, but to be honest with you, the top-tier schools have we have Georgetown as a great exception to that. They're leading the way, but most of them are pretty reluctant.
Okay. I'd like to ask a couple of questions on what a class on electronic discovery is like. Ralph, do you apply the Socratic method to students in this type of class? And is it anything like how Judge Shindlin made requests on the defendant in the Zugelet case did, resulting in sanctions? To the best of your imagination, since I know you weren't there.
Well, I'm teaching sanctions tomorrow in the class, and we're going to be talking about Zuba Lake, and it's great. I mean, it's much more fun, and Judge, if you have an opportunity, I urge you to try it out. Compared to teaching CLEs, where they may or may not be paying attention, and they may be doing their Blackberries while you talk, the classes are much more focused, and you have the opportunity to ask questions. So I do follow the Socratic method. I ask questions, and the beautiful thing is they are starting to ask questions back. And last week before spring break, we were doing metadata, and I had to say, okay, we're going to have to move on now. There were so many questions. I mean, it is something that I think the students understand, that finally they've got an edge from what they've learned, and they know more than their parents, and they know more than the law firms are going to be working with. And I think they get it, and they see this opportunity. So there's a real excitement there in teaching in law schools, and this, kids are very bright, too. A lot of them have some terrific backgrounds. So I do have a lot of hope for the future coming out of that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Judge Shindlin, do you think a class on electronic discovery, which sounds technical in nature and therefore scary to most law students, might have the risk of only getting geek lawyers to sign up?
Actually, no, I don't have that concern at all, because what we've said throughout this call, that people in their 20s don't have the same kind of phobia as we might have had 30 years ago about the word computer or the word technology or the word tapes. I mean, these words are not scary to these people in their 20s. So I don't think that you're only going to get geek lawyers. All the kids in law school have grown up with all of this. It's very familiar to them. They like it. I know that from my law clerks. There's not a law clerk I get now who can't do all kinds of amazing things with computers. So I think they will embrace it. They will not be afraid of it.
That's true. They'll probably be. I mean, I know my kids are on Facebooks and all that, and it's their world.
Well, we have a problem with that. I don't know if you saw the article in today's New York Times that jurors who have long been instructed not to do any research outside the courtroom are now ignoring that instruction, going on Google, going on Facebook, and we just upset three trial verdicts, according to the New York Times, in major cases because jurors confessed to doing all this research online. It's so easy, and they're so used to it. So we have
I don't know what you do about that.
We have a problem with technology now. It's too easy. It's too available. They leave the courtroom and they do their own work. It's terrible. So, I mean, we just have to be firmer in our instructions, but we'll never catch them if they don't tell us.
You have to sanction the jurors.
Well, it's a real, real issue for the court because particularly in a high-profile case, if somebody goes home and Googles it, they're going to hear a lot of things or read a lot of things that we kept out of the trial for evidentiary purposes.
Well,
based on the rules of evidence. So it's a real problem. It's an interesting article, today's Times.
I'll have to definitely look it up. You know, the same sort of question, Ralph, for you, for practitioners today. Do you think we're still finding intimidation within, you know, other lawyers that are practicing about electronic discovery?
Yes, definitely. And that's the generational divide. And that's, I think... one of the things that's very important going on now in the e-discovery world is embracing a new attitude about e-discovery, which Sedona is spearheading, the cooperation proclamation. I know Judge Shenlin has signed on to that. And I think a lot of the reason that so many of my peers, senior litigators, are still doing the old way of fighting through discovery is because they are not comfortable with the discovery because they don't understand the technology. And when you don't really know what's going on, the tendency instinctually seems to be to fall back on old waves of fighting over things. And so, you know, this is part of the problem. And as the attorneys do get more comfortable, they delegate it out, I think you're going to start to see more cooperation. Plus the fact we simply cannot afford to keep playing games with discovery. It's too expensive. So I think, you know, there is an intimidation factor, but people have just got to move beyond it. The clients demand it. They're not going to keep paying through the nose for this kind of outrageous expenses of fighting over things that should simply be stipulated to.
You know, a question just struck me from your answer. I was thinking of a lawyer I was talking to at a fairly sophisticated firm of about 25 lawyers, very strong commercial litigators, and they're in a case where they subpoenaed a third party for email, and it's on a disinterested third party, and they got zero email back, and they're not sure what they're even going to do. They know because they don't know what it'll cost, and you know, is it worth the fight, but you know, I mean, that's the sort of thing that that I think still out there, even within sophisticated law firms. You know, how do you handle that? And as a judge, what would be your advice, Judge?
I'm sorry, my advice on?
On if a lawyer is in a case and they've subpoenaed a third party for
and
email,
and got nothing.
And they got nothing, not a single email back.
Well, since that's logically impossible, I would bring it to the court. I mean, lawyers seem reluctant sometimes to ask the court for help, but that's a case where they definitely should. They can do it in a letter and say, look, I don't want to take the court's time. I don't want to make a motion to compel, but it's inherently impossible that there are zero emails. Something's wrong here. And then the parties come into court, and the judge works with the parties, and the judge has knowledge, and suddenly the situation changes, and hundreds are produced. I mean, we're all familiar with last year's Qualcomm versus Broadcom case where there were no emails, and suddenly there were 500,000 pages. But it took terrible persistence on the part of the adversary and then eventually the court to force the party to cough them up. And the first response was, there are none. Well, then suddenly there's tons, and we've had that experience in case after case.
Well, that pulled us in a different direction there. So getting back onto the topic, the biggest lesson, Judge Shedlin, and also to you, Ralph, is What do you think is the biggest lesson we can teach our law students and newbie electronic discovery lawyers?
The biggest lesson. You mean within the substantive area of e-discovery?
Yes.
Substantive area. Well, I've been following the cases in recent years, and I think the biggest topic that's evolving is to think hard about the effectiveness of the search protocol that you develop, because there seem to be too many failed protocols. People think they've searched and they haven't looked in the right places. They haven't communicated with the right people. They haven't used the best technology to go through the materials they do have. I had a case recently with many, many millions of documents, and the privilege review was so poorly done that it simply failed to identify the privileged documents. And then when the attorney realized it, he asked for a second chance, and that pretty well failed too, and a third chance. And the point is that people just aren't getting this right. And I think Magistrate Judge Grimm wrote a very fine opinion in Victor Stanley versus Creative Pipe, where he explained the same problem, that nobody even quality tested the protocol that the client and or vendor were using to see if it was working. So if I were to pick on one issue, I would say you have to test to see if what you've developed is a good way to search materials and produce relevant non-privileged information.
That's heartening to hear, because that's what I focus on. But anyway,
well,
thank you.
You disagree with what I said, Ralph, or you think it's right on?
No, that is very important. And I would just phrase it a little differently insofar as the primary thing I found myself coming back to and explaining to the law students particularly is related to that, and that is the whole notion of proportionality, of scale, and of the importance of understanding 26B2C and achieving a balance between the value of a case, the importance of the case, and what the cost may be in the different kinds of information available. The kind of thing that you address so well in Zuba Lake and other cases. I mean, this is a fundamental thing where I think many lawyers have lost track of it, and they've gotten so involved in the chase, they aren't coming back to the fundamental question, should I really be spending $1 million to track down email when on the best day this case is only worth $2 million? Is that the right thing? Is that fair? Is that comply with the just and quick adjudication of justice?
Well,
so I'm trying to drill that in everyone's head, and also the notion of discovery is not a field where there should be battles and contests. It should be a cooperative search for the truth, and that, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand. Let's put the facts on the table, and let's then argue about what the facts mean. There's plenty of room for adversarial and arguments and presentations to judge and jury, but not about technical things like metadata or do you need it or not. You know, let's get real with that.
Well, Ralph, I'd like to, for just a moment, challenge a little piece of what you said. You know, you don't want to spend, you said, $1 million on discovery when the case is at best worth $2 million. But what do you do when you are the defendant and you're not there voluntarily and you're being asked to produce information? Are you saying that rather than spend that money, you ought to throw in the towel and just settle the case? Because I'm worried, and many people are worried, about the high cost of e-discovery allowing extortion to occur in a settlement. Because from the defense perspective, you don't have a choice. You have to spend what it takes to properly respond to the request. You must do it. You can't just say, well, it's too expensive, I can't do this. You have to do it. You can try to seek cost shifting. You can try to involve the court in apportioning cost. But at the end of the day, you either do it or you're going to pay in a settlement. And I know there's been a fear, I hear it all the time in the bar, that the cost of e-discovery is shifting the ground in terms of the ability to extort settlements. And I'd like to hear what you think of that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad to hear your concern about that. I share that doing primarily defense work. Of course, in e-discovery, it's not so much defense as it is requester or producer. And the producing party, if it's a larger corporation, David and Goliath, can be behind the eight ball. But I do think that a large company is entitled to protection, and that there is no need to try and find every piece of relevant email, but you should scale your search. And we should be thinking in terms, as I know you do, rolling productions in a series. Let's start off, let's see what we can get in an economical manner and produce that first and then come back with secondary, more focused discovery. Because, I don't think you should have to spend $1 million to find electronic evidence if the case is $2 million. I think that's where you go immediately for protection. And do not allow yourself to be extorted by the cost of a lawsuit.
That's the key point. You can't use self-help. You either go for protection by coming to court, or you comply. But you can't take the middle ground and just ignore it, put your head in the sand, do it halfway, and then say, well, the reason I didn't do better is it was too expensive. That's what you can't do, and that's where I think a lot of lawyers make a mistake.
You know, these are both great topics, and I'm going to do shows on both of those topics because they're great. And I was more digging for future shows, and so consider those preview answers. I want to wrap up here with just a couple of quick questions on the book. The textbook, by the way, I skimmed through the content, and it looks like it's about 650 pages long. It's extremely comprehensive, lots of cases, hundreds of issues. Do you think there's a larger market for this book for lawyers or young lawyers to get this book, or is it really for law students?
Well, it was certainly created for law students, but it wouldn't be the first case book where a practitioner says, given what's available on the market, I think I'd like to own this book. So I have had a number of practitioners who told me they bought it. It's funny, I get an email saying, I bought your case book. I mean, I didn't ask them to. I don't know why they did, but I guess there's not so much on the market, and they thought it might be a useful way to learn. So while I didn't envision it for the lawyer market, which is one reason we're coming out with the nutshell, it certainly can't hurt, and I expect that it is going to be on a number of lawyers' bookshelves.
My last quick question is, given the collaborative nature of law, I know there were, in the voluminous content in the book, that there have to have been people that helped you write it, and if you wanted to thank anyone.
Oh, we did. It's all in the preface. I don't want to single one person out and forget to name another, but a co-author of the book is the Sedona Conference. So the Sedona Conference used volunteers who are members of the conference to help with some of the sections. And as I said, I know if I start to name one name, I'll forget another, but it's all in the preface. They're all thanked individually. And we were very grateful to the members of the Sedona Conference who contributed to the book, in addition to the work that Professor Capra and I did. So obviously, Ken Withers, the educational director, was the coordinator of the volunteers. So Ken's name I certainly can mention separately. But other than that, just in general, we want to thank the Sedona Conference and its volunteers.
Great. And we're going to have Richard Brayman on a show in a couple of weeks talking about collaboration initiative and trying to get better cooperation out there. But I want to thank both of you for living with the technical glitches. We are in an electronic world, and I'm glad that we were able to come up with a backup plan. I hope we will do future shows on other topics. I know Ralph, we're talking about one, and thank you again for your participation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, take
Bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.